Will technology save us from the worst impacts of climate chaos? Or will it pose moral hazards that just kick the can down the road?
If there's any way that we could, you know, continue to burn fossil fuels and avoid the worst impacts of climate change, and you dangle that in front of people and politicians and fossil fuel companies, they will seize on it and not do, you know, the right thing, I will put it as bluntly as that, and really work to ramp down CO2 emissions as quickly as possible. And I think that all of these possible technological fixes do raise very serious moral hazard questions. And I think that everyone working on them would say that they raise serious moral hazard questions. Now, the problem that we have, or the answer to that is, well, you know, look, we're not doing anything. You know? So the moral hazard or no moral hazard, you know, how are we going to cope?
That's Elizabeth Colbert. We talk with her about her new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Then wildlife photographer extraordinaire Ian Shive goes to the volcanic Aleutian Islands of Alaska.
And so you have this very intricate, wonderful web of life that is relying on this destructive power of volcanoes. And, you know, I found that very fascinating because we think of volcanoes as something that is destructive or blows up, you know, erupts and everything, but we don't necessarily think of it as a life giver. And that's what this is in the Aleutian Islands.
Ian Shive tells us about the stunning new documentary he's in, The Last Unknown. It's streaming now on Discovery 2. That and more is all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Have you heard the trope that technology will save us from climate catastrophe? Well, that may have to be true because our inaction now calls for drastic measures. But will the cure be as bad or worse than the disease? Will solar engineering, for example, blot out so much of the sun's light that crops will fail all over the globe? So pervasive are human impacts on the planet that it's said we live in a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene. In her latest book, Under a White Sky, Elizabeth Colbert takes a hard look at the new world we're creating. She examines how the very sorts of interventions that have imperiled our planet are increasingly seen as the only hope for its salvation. By turns inspiring, terrifying, and darkly comic, Under a White Sky is an utterly original examination of the challenges we face. Elizabeth Colbert is the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, and The Sixth Extinction, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize and which we interviewed her about in 2014. She's also a staff writer at The New Yorker. Well, Elizabeth Colbert, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed this book. This is one of the few books about the climate crisis that I can say I actually enjoyed.
Well, thank you.
You put a lot of yourself in it, and there are a lot of great stories. And you write that this is a book about people trying to solve problems created by people trying to solve problems. And most notably, it really is, I think, the kind of cautionary tales that we need to take to heart as we deal with the climate crisis. You start the book with an artificial river in Chicago. Why was it built, and what has its impact been on the hydrology of the entire country?
So the sort of faux river in question here is called the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. And it was built at the very beginning of the 20th century, or dug, I suppose I should say. It was a massive construction project, one of the biggest of its day. And it its purpose was to quite literally reverse the flow of the Chicago River. So the Chicago had sort of grown up on the banks of the Chicago River, which flowed through the city and into east, into Lake Michigan. And as the city grew, it just used the river basically as an open sewer, dumping all of its human waste, and also as the city's tremendous stockyards grew, all of its animal waste. So the river was, you know, just terribly, you know, revolting. It was said it was so thick with filth that a chicken could walk across it without getting her feet wet. And this was, you know, not just disgusting, it was also a really terrible public health hazard. So there was a lot of waterborne disease in Chicago, because Chicago, I should also mention, gets its drinking water from the lake, from Lake Michigan. So it was decided that something had to be done, that something was this tremendous construction project, which reversed the flow of the river so that now, instead of flowing into Lake Michigan, it flowed basically into the Mississippi River system, not directly into the Mississippi, but into rivers that eventually flow into the Mississippi. And that had this weird, unintended side effect. I mean, I guess everyone knew that it was happening, but no one paid much attention to it at the time, of connecting the Great Lakes and the Mississippi drainage basins, which should be entirely separate. And over the course of the 20th century, both the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River system became highly invaded water systems. So just filled with invasive species, you know, wreaking havoc in different ways. And at the turn of the 21st century, it was decided, well, something has to be done about that. Something has to be done about the way that invasive species from one basin are getting into the other basin. And that something that was decided this time was to actually electrify a portion of that canal that had been built to send Chicago's, you know, sewage down the Mississippi. So now if you travel along the Senator and Ship Canal out of Chicago, you're traveling west now, you come to a part of the canal that is where they pulse tremendous amounts of electricity into the water. And there are huge signs that say, you know, do not go in the water, keep your pets with you, et cetera, because you will get electrocuted.
Yeah, it seems kind of crazy. I mean, the first time they did it, they killed an awful lot of fish that were not the intended target.
Yes, I mean, the barrier, they're called the electric barriers. Actually, there's a series of barriers where they pulse electricity into the water. And the intention is, the hope is that the fish that are trying to swim, you know, from the Mississippi system into the Great Lakes or vice versa, will hit this area of, you know, high voltage area, will get a shock and will turn around as opposed to being before they get killed. Now, I can't tell you exactly how, you know, well that works, but the fish that got killed, the tremendous number of fish that you're alluding to, that was an intentional poisoning when they shut down the barriers temporarily.
So talking about the Mississippi River then, go on to talk about Louisiana, New Orleans, and Plaquemine Parish. Louisiana's shedding a football field's worth of land every hour and a half. You know, a lot of people, including myself, assumed that it was all about sea level rise driven by global warming. But it's actually more than that. It's really another, at least partially, a case of trying to correct a problem and creating a bigger one.
Yes, exactly. So that, in this case, we're talking about another immense construction project that was, it's really been 300 years in the making ever since New Orleans was founded by the French back in 1718. And when the French settled New Orleans, which was, you know, the swampy area right in the crook, basically, of the Mississippi River, at that point, the Mississippi was prone to overflowing its banks constantly. And in fact, all of southern Louisiana and all of the land that New Orleans is built on was formed that way by the Mississippi overflowing its banks, you know, usually in spring when the water is very high and it's carrying a lot of sediment. It overflowed its banks. And when the Mississippi flooded and overtopped its banks, it would drop this sediment across the landscape. And that was how the land formed. That's how the land under under New Orleans formed. And the French began this enterprise of trying to keep the Mississippi from flooding. And that project has lasted, you know, to this day, with hundreds of miles of levees and flood walls and huge waterworks pumping water out. And that's been pretty successful on one level, but you can sort of tell where this is going, which is that the land is now starved of sediment and it doesn't get replenished. And so the city is sinking very fast.
So pumping the water out means that the land subsides even more. You know, it just seems time and again, better solutions that you write about in this book, in Under a White Sky, Elizabeth Colbert, better solutions are bypassed because of political considerations. I mean, for example, coastal retreat. This is something we're facing where I live out on the east end of Long Island. You know, very clearly we are soon going to be, Montauk is going to be an island, and the coastline where all the hotels are is going to be inundated, and nobody wants to go inland. Explain how the solutions for New Orleans after Sandy Hurricane Sandy, have actually made it more vulnerable to storm surge than before.
Well, every time there's a big, you know, disaster in Louisiana, it's a pattern you see played out over and over again. So after Katrina in particular, New Orleans was, you know, billions of dollars were spent to try to protect the city better. Now, that was a case where the city was really hit with, not with the Mississippi flooding so much as flooding, you know, that came in from the Gulf. But when you build up the levees and you keep pumping more and more water out of the city, sort of two things happen. First of all, you make any potential breach of those levees that much more catastrophic. And you also, as you pump more and more water out of the ground, you're actually aiding, you know, fostering the sinking of the city. So the city's in kind of a very vicious cycle here, where the same techniques that have been used to protect it are unfortunately also contributing to its, you know, subsidence.
And now you also devote some time to solutions. I guess, how is it, one person says in the book, you know, that the predicament is that if there's, or maybe you say this, is that if there's to be any answer to the problem of control, it's going to be more control. And you bring up some biological responses to habitat loss and species extinction. We spoke with you last about your book, The Sixth Extinction, which is about species extinction. So there are experiments using genetic engineering like CRISPR and gene drives to engineer species to withstand the threats or to become less threats as invasive species. Talk about some of them and what are the conundrums that they may bring up?
Well, this is another, you know, example. You know, the book basically follows all these examples of situations that people have created by interfering in one way or another with natural processes, either the flooding of the Mississippi or the flow of the Chicago River, or in the case of some of the chapters that involve biology, by moving species around the world, or by, you know, wrecking a species habitat, or by, in one case, warming up the entire ocean. And in every case, now we're faced with this question, okay, well, these changes that we've brought about, in a lot of other species are suffering as a result of that. So now there's sort of, you know, this sort of new wave of conservation projects that aim to actually manipulate the species themselves. So it's conceivable nowadays, because of the extraordinary advances that have been made in gene editing, to identify traits that would allow species to withstand various threats and to try to gene edit them so that, you know, they possess that the right genetic tweet. And that's, I think, going to become a bigger and bigger question in conservation is, you know, to what extent, if you're trying to save a species, but you have to change it to save it, you know, to what extent are you saving that species? And we're going to have to answer that question because, you know, there are so many threats to so many species, and because gene editing is such a potentially powerful tool.
So now let's talk about some of the other conundrums. And you're not really saying we shouldn't do the, it's more like, here we are, right? This is what we're faced with. We either...
Exactly. Here we are. That's a pretty good way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, we either destroy everything or just maybe something, and we may end up destroying everything anyway, but we might just save ourselves. So let's turn to climate impacts. First of all, I'd like to ask you about something that I never knew before, and that is, you say that ice cores that go hundreds of thousands of years into the past, that is, they are taken, their samples taken from deep enough in the Arctic ice to show the climate back that far. You say they show that the climate has actually been incredibly unstable with, you know, huge swings, you know, even larger swings than we anticipate seeing here before, and in, sometimes in very, you know, in the case of decades, not millennia. What does this mean for us?
Well, that's a very interesting question that no one can answer at this point. We, you know, ice cores from Greenland are an extraordinarily powerful tool for looking at the climate of the past. And what they contain is, if you know how to read them, as it were, is an archive of temperatures going back to basically the beginning of the last ice age, so about 110, 115,000 years ago. And what these ice cores show, and they've shown time and time again, and now is just basically accepted as a fact, is that during the last ice age, which only ended about 12,000 years ago, there were these huge temperature swings, as you say, that occurred in a matter of decades. So temperatures would, you know, warm up to almost non-ice age conditions, and then they'd plunge again. And whether this is a function of how you could get such powerful swings so quickly is really still an open question. No one is entirely sure of that. And whether they could potentially, such a swing could potentially be triggered, you know, by our own messing around with the climate is unclear, because now we are no longer in an ice age. We're in what should be an interglacial period, a period between ice ages, although we have succeeded in putting off the next ice age for all intents and purposes forever through our carbon emissions. But no one is entirely sure what the mechanism was, and so no one is entirely sure whether we are risking another such climate swing.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with climate and environmental journalist Elizabeth Colbert about her latest book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. So we've basically reached a point where our only way for, you know, survival basically is to find a way to take carbon out of the atmosphere. This is the holy grail. Is it feasible?
Well, we I don't want to say our only method of survival, but if you look at all of these efforts to keep average global temperatures under a certain threshold, from rising more than, let's say, 1.5 degrees Celsius, which at this point is almost impossible, or more than 2 degrees Celsius, which at this point is still possible, but very, very difficult. If you look at the sort of what are called scenarios that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change uses, they all contain large amounts of what have been dubbed negative emissions. So, you know, you throw CO2 into the atmosphere, that's a regular emission, positive emission, as it were, and a negative emission would be taking it out. Now, how do we do that? That is a question that I think is going to occupy a lot of people's time and brain power in coming decades. Elon Musk, in fact, just announced a $100 million prize to the team that could come up with a plausible way of removing a billion tons of CO2 from the atmosphere every year. So a lot of people, I think, are going to be vying for that pot of money.
And doesn't that kind of create a moral hazard? I mean, that along with some of the other proposals, which we'll talk about in a minute, that's geoengineering, you know, that's actually changing the climate on purpose in order to forestall climate change. Talk about the issue of moral hazard, where we just keep on polluting and using up our entire fossil fuel reserves, pumping them into the atmosphere with all the impacts that implies.
Well, what's called the moral hazard problem, some people would argue it's not really accurate to call it a moral hazard, but we won't get into the sort of philosophical nitty gritty here. But, you know, the issue here is, look, if there's any way that we could, you know, continue to burn fossil fuels and avoid the worst impacts of climate change, and you dangle that in front of people and politicians and fossil fuel companies, they will seize on it and not do, you know, the right thing. I will put it as bluntly as that. And really work to ramp down CO2 emissions as quickly as possible. And I think that all of these possible technological, you know, fixes do raise very serious moral hazard questions. And I think that everyone working on them would say that they raise serious moral hazard questions. Now, the problem that we have, or the answer to that is, well, you know, look, we're not doing anything. You know? So the moral hazard or no moral hazard, you know, how are we going to cope? So these are pretty tough, you know, tough questions that I don't think anyone has a particularly good, straightforward answer to.
So talk about the proposal to, which is where the title of your book comes from, actually, the proposal to kind of imitate the action of volcanoes and put sulfuric acid particles in the atmosphere?
Yeah, sulfur dioxide, but yeah, basically, yeah. So, you know, one of the really big challenges of dealing with climate change is that CO2 is not like a lot of conventional air pollutants, which will fall out of the atmosphere, you know, given a few years, right? So, you know, when we decided to try to reduce smog, and we all put catalytic converters, you know, bought cars with catalytic converters, it made a huge difference in a relatively short amount of time. But even once you stop emitting CO2, the CO2 is going to hang around in the atmosphere for a long, long time. And it's going to continue to warm the planet. It's going to continue to, you know, melt the ice caps for quite a while. So if you get to a point where you say, well, you know, this climate is really, you know, insupportable either for humans or for other forms of life, then you don't have a lot of options for doing something fast. Even carbon dioxide removal is a very slow process and its impacts would be quite slow. The only fast thing that people have come up with, and this is once again really just an idea at this point, but it's a plausible idea, is you could put some kind of reflective particle in the stratosphere. Either you would spray sulfur dioxide, or some people have suggested calcium carbonate dust. And there's even a suggestion of, you know, diamond dust, and it would reflect. It would create a sort of haze, stratospheric haze, that would reflect sunlight back to space and have a cooling effect. And as you mentioned, this is what volcanoes do. They spew a lot of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. This creates these tiny little droplets that are highly reflective. They reflect sunlight back to space. So after a major volcanic eruption, we get these beautiful sunsets, and we also get a temporary cooling effect. So that is the idea behind what's become known as solar geoengineering, that we would sort of purposefully create these post-volcanic conditions in the stratosphere.
And finally, Elizabeth Culbert, you've been writing about this for a long time. Your book, The Sixth Extinction, was, you know, it was a gut punch to read. I mean, it's not that, you know, we don't know what's happening, but to read about all the species that we're losing is tragic. This is the first book in which you're talking about potential solutions, you know, even though each solution has its own conundrum. Have you shifted at all in your sense of where we're going from here? I mean, I'm not asking you to be a fortune teller, but just how you deal with this. Do you feel any hope, or did you just feel like we're not in any place where we should be?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm particularly hopeful. I mean, everything that I talk about in the book, you know, from carbon dioxide removal to geoengineering, those are, you know, people looking for solutions. But when you think about what the solution is, you know, is it to re-engineer the stratosphere? If that's this quote unquote solution, then, you know, it seems to me we're in a pretty big jam. And we are in a pretty big jam. That's really the whole point of the book. We are in a jam. We have messed around with these systems very fundamentally, and we don't have any easy answers left. And another point of the book is that, or another message that I hope comes through in the book is, you know, leaving things alone, saying, oh, let's all just, you know, leave things alone at this point. That's not really an option either. You know, we're just in this very deep, and there are almost 8 billion people on the planet. And so we're in a pretty tight corner. And what will emerge at the end of all this is absolutely, you know, in my view, the most urgent question of our time. I still do believe there are bad choices and there are worse choices. And we have to avoid making the worst choices. But I am afraid I don't think there are any clear or, you know, elegant answers left.
So when one of the points that you make in the book is it's not just about one solution either.
Yes, you mean one grand solution that's going to solve all our problems?
Mm-hmm. That it's more of a like all of the above.
Well, I honestly don't, you know, we are definitely ad hocking, if you can use ad hoc as a verb. We are ad hocking our way through these situations. And the problem, to add another layer to it, is that these situations are unprecedented. They're not situations that, you know, humanity or any other species has dealt with in the past, because they are truly only problems that would emerge when you have a highly technological, globalized society, you know, that we've only had arguably for, you know, maybe a couple centuries, but, you know, by some accounts, maybe only a few decades. And so we are in an unprecedented situation. I talk about, you know, creating no analog climates, no analog ecosystems. We can't look to the past for patterns or answers or what worked in the past, because we are simply in uncharted territory right now.
And on that note, I want to thank you so much, Elizabeth Colbert. I mean, your writing is so important for us. You remind us where we are with an unstinting eye. And also, this was a terrific read.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I do want to say, I know that this has been a pretty heavy conversation, but I do want to say that the book, I hope, has a dark comic element to it that I hope comes through.
It does. And it makes it an enjoyable read, as we have images of the Dance of Death. Thank you. Thanks again for talking with us.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Colbert. You can read an excerpt from Under a White Sky at writersvoice.net. Next up, The Last Unknown. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. They're free. You can also find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Now, The Last Unknown with Ian Shive.
Beyond oceans, shrouded in mystery and intrigue. A freezing sea between Siberia and Alaska. There is an archipelago of battered islands. The Aleutian Islands are some of the most remote, inaccessible, and wildest places in the world.
Wow.
Comprised of 14 large volcanoes.
Steep.
And 55 smaller ones.
Yeah, it's possible for steam explosions to occur.
Well, sounds like fun.
It's a place few people have ever seen before. It's a place I never thought I'd get to see. And there's only one way to get there. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is on a one-of-a-kind research mission to the Aleutian Islands to assess the populations of the wildlife, revealing secrets of this ecosystem, and informing the world about the health of our oceans. I'm joining this team of scientists to help document their findings. As a photographer, my job is to share their story so that we can all understand why these islands are vital to the health of our planet. But this is a tough place.
Absolutely brutal.
These islands will not give up their secrets easily. Join me, Ian Shive, on a high-stakes ride into one of the most pristine ecosystems on the planet, far beyond, and into the last unknown.
That's a trailer to The Last Unknown, a thrilling new documentary that's just started streaming on Discovery 2 and featuring wildlife photographer Ian Shive. We last spoke with Shive in December 2020 about his gorgeous coffee table book, Refuge. It's about America's wildlife refuges. That book and this film are reminders that we still have an abundance of wildlife to save and protect. Ian Shive, welcome back to Writer's Voice. Last time we spoke with you about your wonderful book about the wildlife refuges, and now we're talking about a documentary that you have completed that's going to air on Discovery Plus on March 18th, The Last Unknown. Where did you go? Where is this last unknown?
Well, thank you for having me. And the show takes place in the Aleutian Islands, and it's a part of Alaska that I think a lot of people may not be aware of, is overlooked. Of course, Alaska is such a beautiful and magnificent state with everything from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and national parks like Denali down into the Kenai Peninsula. But as you get further south off of the Kenai Peninsula, there's this sort of necklace of islands that sweeps out south and west out towards Russia, about 1,100 miles from the mainland, and 2,500 islands called the Aleutians. And so I was part of a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service expedition out to those islands. We went to several different islands looking at the health of wildlife populations, seabirds and mammals, as well as exploring a lot of the places that we just didn't really know what there would be. So for me, The Last Unknown is that part of Alaska that we're featuring on our show on Discovery Plus.
And it's a really fierce place.
It is. It really is. It's let's put it this way. It's not a typical cruise to Alaska, right? We're taking a small research vessel. You're traversing the Bering Sea and the North Pacific. So if you're familiar with Deadliest Catch, for instance, like that's a great example of what we're dealing with. So you'll see a lot of waves coming up over the bow of our boat as it gets tossed around in the ocean. But on top of that, it's cold, not freezing cold, not while we were there, because most of the work is done in the summer months, but it's still quite cold. You know, it's always sort of 40 degrees or so, give or take a few degrees. It's always really wet and windy, which just makes it all that more difficult. I would say the one thing that you get used to relatively quickly and is unavoidable is how wet you will be. You're always relying on waders that cover, you know, top 75, 90% of your body or so. It's really just your shoulders and face that are out. And it's because you're not only getting rained on, but you might be jumping out of a small skiff on a beach and you're in the ocean, which is cold. And it's just a tough place. You know, it's rugged. And the thing with that is the ruggedness is what protects those islands in many ways. I mean, they're protected as part of a national wildlife refuge, but they're also really protected by remote isolation and the difficulty and challenges of getting to them. And even if you get to them, the beaches are hard to land on. They're covered with boulders and that are slippery from seaweed and kelp that's on them. And then, okay, you've made it past there. You find yourself onto the beach. There's no trails. You know, there's a lot of unknown factors of where do I go from here? What am I going to see? So it's a very interesting place to work for sure. But that's what makes it so spectacular and why there's so many incredible secrets that are there to be revealed with the camera.
And it has some of the most abundant wildlife of certain species in the world. For example, I believe it's said that it has the largest population of fur seals. Is that correct?
Yeah, one of the largest populations of northern fur seals in the world is on this island that they congregate on called Bogoslav Island. And it is a sight to behold. I mean, to see 140,000 grouchy, ornery, blubbery things bouncing around on the beach, fighting each other, you know, trying to claim territory or to mate, or, you know, there's also just so many little pups when we were there as well. It was the pupping season. So there's adorable little baby fur seals all over. And just that alone would be a sight to behold. But then add to the fact that you're on this island is a very small island. You know, if we were to walk around, it might only take half an hour or so to walk around. But it's also an active volcano, and it's the tip of an active volcano. Most of it is actually submerged in the surrounding ocean. And so you've got steam and bubbling cauldrons of mud and water and a lot of fumaroles and geologic features that just make this and the sand is all completely black as well. And so it just looks like an absolutely primordial landscape. I've never seen anything like it. I've had the privilege of photographing and working in over 45 countries around the world, and I have never seen anything like Bogoslav Island.
Right. And the volcanic nature of the island is also a secret to the abundance of the wildlife around it. Tell us why that's so.
Well, the secret to all of the Aleutians is in the volcanoes. And that's something that I wasn't really fully expecting, but learned through the scientists that I was with from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and learned also just by, you know, the visuals of it and a lot of the research that was into it. And so you're dealing, the Aleutians are the north end of the Ring of Fire, the Ring of Fire being the very active, geologically active zone of the Pacific that goes all the way around, from California down to the south over to the west side, across down through Asia. And so as the north end of the Ring of Fire, you have about 80 some volcanoes in the Aleutian chain. And they're not even sure exactly how many are there. So you're talking about an extraordinarily volcanically active part of Earth. And a large part of what's happening and why there is such abundant wildlife there is with volcanic eruptions, when they erupt, the minerals go up into the ocean, especially underwater eruptions, which there's a lot of those there. And that those nutrients are essentially welled up by the volcanic eruptions, and they feed some of the basic foundations of life. So things like plankton, for instance, the very small, almost microscopic creatures that a lot of things like seabirds eat, and small fish. And then those creatures in turn attract larger animals like fur seals, and then fur seals in abundance also attract other things like whales, same with plankton. So you get humpback whales and orcas and minke and all kinds of other whales up there. And so you have this very intricate, wonderful web of life that is relying on this destructive power of volcanoes. And, you know, I found that very fascinating because we think of volcanoes as something that is destructive or blows up, you know, erupts and everything, but we don't necessarily think of it as a life giver. And that's what this is in the Aleutian Islands. It is a life giver. And you know, we saw another example of it in a different way where these seabirds called auklets, they look like, you know, cross between a penguin and a parakeet. They're really cute, about 10 inches tall, really colorful beaks and headdresses and on them. They're just great to watch. And they rely, their nesting grounds are upturned boulders. So like you get like a big sort of boulder field with these little tunnels, isn't maybe the right word, but they're kind of like tunnels, little miniature caves all over the place. And the auklets, which mostly spend most of their lives and time at sea, they rely on these areas for nesting and mating. And they go down in these little boulders. And that's where they raise their families and do their thing. Well, as they spend more and more time in these boulders, eventually their excrement, their poop, turns into almost like a soil of sorts, and grass starts to grow and plants start to grow. And what happens is those tunnels start to get closed off by all of the growth from the seabirds. And so eventually that habitat becomes unmanageable for the birds. They can't use it anymore because they've been using it so much. They can't use it anymore. And so they rely on the volcano to erupt, to redisturb all of those rocks, to re-churn those rocks and create fresh habitat for them. So the islands and the life are really very much tied to all of these interesting geologic phenomena that take place.
Yeah, wow, that's a wonderful story. And getting back to the fur seals, that's also a recovery success story.
It is, yeah. It's not a full recovery, though. So some of their numbers show that they're starting to decline again, but for different reasons. So the northern fur seals were almost completely eradicated by their namesake fur. A lot of fur trappers and places like the Pribilof Islands, which are also part of Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, but the Pribs, as they're called, the Pribilof Islands are north of the Aleutian Chain a little bit, and sort of out there on their own. And those were once a major hub for hunting these fur seals, almost to the point of extinction. And eventually, through protections and the evolution of our society into protecting and recognizing the damage we were doing, we were able to protect them, create habitat for them. You know, creating sanctuaries and refuges and all kinds of things that ultimately allowed their numbers to recover. And so to see 140,000 on the beach like we did is obviously a great sight, and they are in huge abundance, but it does seem that their numbers are starting to decline again. And so a lot of that appears to be related to the health of the ocean and the changes happening to our planet and climate change.
Could you just say a little bit more about specifically what part of the ocean decline is creating the stress on them?
Well, all of the world's oceans are under duress from overfishing, from climate change, ocean acidification. You know, it's just just pollution, plastic issues. You know, the lists are long. I'm not specifically the most educated on, how impacted different things are to fur seals, each of those things. But obviously, you know, they rely on fish to eat. I mean, that's what they do. And so as there are less and we continue to disturb that food chain throughout all of the Pacific, then they are obviously impacted because of their food resource. It's important to note, too, you know, these animals don't just live up on these islands in the middle of nowhere. A fur seal will travel, it spends most of its life at sea as well, just like the seabirds. Spends most of its life at sea, only goes to these islands to mate and to congregate for that purpose. But they will travel as far south as Los Angeles, 3,000 miles away. So fur seal, I might see up in the Aleutian Chain of Alaska, maybe down here warming up on the beach in Malibu. And so, you know, you're talking about a huge swath of ocean. And so you're looking at similarly just a huge number of challenges that they will face in that journey.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with wildlife photographer Ian Shive about the new documentary he's in and streaming now on Discovery 2, called The Last Unknown. It's about a journey he took with scientists of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to one of the most remote places on Earth, the Aleutian Islands. He went there to document wildlife populations like stellar sea lions and auklet bird colonies. And it's not just them. You also mentioned the stellar sea lions, their declines there, and the storm petrels. Tell us about those two species.
Yes, stellar sea lions are also endangered. They're on the endangered species list. And so we didn't see huge amounts of them. We saw some rookeries. A rookery is where a stellar sea lion will haul out of the water, very much like the fur seal for, congregating and mating and so on. And they're quite a bit larger than the fur seals, which is at first when you're filming them pretty intimidating because they are also get kind of curious and they'll come up and swim and you might feel like they're going to come to you and they kind of make you a little nervous when something that large, these huge animals, will come towards you. But yeah, they are on the endangered, they considered, I guess, technically a near threatened species of sea lion. And it's not as big as a walrus, but it is fairly large. I would say it's very similar in size to, from what I can tell, from what I've seen of walruses as well. And they similarly are having, I would say, somewhat unexplained declines. I mean, again, you know, the health of the ocean is a great indicator of why things are declining. And, you know, it's just yet another thing that's happening. And yeah, you mentioned storm petrels, I believe, as well. And, you know, we had mixed results with the seabird colonies. I would say we saw mostly positive things. And in general, I think the refuge and the protection it affords really was working. We saw a lot of things working and working really well, which is why it's important that we continue to protect places like this. But, you know, we saw really healthy auklet colonies, you know, the puffins, which are just so fun to watch and clumsy and, you know, they're just colorful, great to photograph. They were also very healthy. Storm petrels have been generally healthy this year. They said they weren't growing as fast, which means that their food source is depleted, which means there's a problem going on in the ocean of some kind. And so, you know, it varies from year to year quite a bit. You know, you may have some good years, some really bad years, which is what we, you know, learn and sort of explore in this documentary. But it's also why the work of these scientists is so important, because they go back year after year. And that's the only way to really know, are things improving? Is it just a fluke of a bad year? Or is there a trend happening? And it's the trends that are the most indicative of, you know, what's going on out there.
Yes. And Ian Shive, the last time we spoke with you about your book about the wildlife refuges, the American wildlife refuges, we were still under the Trump administration. And you talked about the devastation of some of the policies of the Trump administration. Now that we have a new administration, what, you know, do you feel more hope? What are you looking forward to?
Yes, I absolutely feel more hope. I don't know how you could not feel more hope after what I think the last 4 years have been for the environment here in the United States. So, yes, I think that, you know, seeing Secretary Holland get confirmed and is great. And I think that, you know, already the initiatives and things that we're seeing take place are great indicators of what, you know, his administration is working on. And I'm just full of hope. I think that, you know, we could not only undo a lot of the damage that was done, but actually start to see some real progress in protecting areas and ensuring they stay protected, you know, for forever, if possible. So, yes, I think it's one of the great things that we have to look forward to. And I certainly hope that, you know, we can play a role in sharing these places with people so they can see the value in protecting them. You know, and that's a big part of why I put my book together, Refuge, America's Wildest Places, and why our show, The Last Unknown on Discovery, are so important, because that is how most people are going to explore a lot of these places. Not everybody's going to get on a ship for weeks on end and go look at a tiny little island or, you know, explore some coral reef that has maybe never been explored before, but may hold important secrets for medicine, for other coral reefs, things like that. So, you know, for me, you know, I see my role as sort of a bridge between these places, and I hope that that helps people understand the value of them.
Yes, and that's the value of wildlife photography as well, because you really bring it alive. I mean, this is a stunning documentary, The Last Unknown, and your book Refuge was an absolutely stunning book. It's just extraordinary. But I'd like to ask you, now, does Deb Holland, is Interior what oversees the wildlife refuges?
Yeah, so the National Wildlife Refuge System and the National Park System, National Forest, those are all under the Department of the Interior. And so ultimately, the Secretary of the Interior is the top of the food chain on that. The only environmental organization that does a lot of exploration and work on climate and oceans is the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, and they're actually under the Department of Commerce. So they're the only one that's sort of outside the DOI branch. But yes, the DOI umbrella includes the refuge system.
So if you could have a meeting with Secretary Holland, you know, in the next couple of weeks, what would you ask her to do?
I mean, I think everything I've read about her, I think she's doing it, but I would really look to figure out how we can make a better transition. I think transition is a key word, from fossil fuels to sustainable energy in places, and making sure that we're not going into places like Chaco Canyon, where, you know, they've been battling there for energy exploitation. You know, that's an important cultural resource and historic resource for all people, but obviously, you know, for our cultures of the Southwest, Native American cultures of the Southwest. So we really have to find some sort of balance. We can't keep going into national parks and protected areas with the hope of, you know, exploiting them for the resources that may be there below. And similarly, I would ask her to look at that. And obviously, we can't just pull the plug out of the wall and say, well, you know, goodbye to all those jobs. But I think a good plan will look at how to transition those jobs and those positions into sustainable energy work and jobs, while also protecting places and extending protections, extending more protections to refuges, and giving Americans more opportunity to be outdoors. I think the one thing we've really learned during COVID is that, you know, the foundation, the place we go to for our own protection, I guess, in many ways, the place we have sought out and continue to seek are our public lands and waters. That's why campgrounds and national parks are more full than ever before. And we need more of them. You know, we should not be turning families away or people away who want to camp. What we need to do is extend protected areas and land and give people the freedom to roam and the freedom to connect with nature in this country, because, you know, during this crisis, we've learned it's very important to us. So, you know, that would be my hope with what I see her doing.
That's great. Now, tell us more about how people can see The Last Unknown.
It's, of course, on Discovery Plus. It's a streaming service. You just get onto your Apple TV or whatever device you're using to connect to different streaming services. And, you know, I'm really excited because it's a new service. I've been obviously watching our show and flipping around, checking it out. But it's there on Discovery Plus, and they do have a free trial as well. If you're not sure and you want to check it out, you can check out our show, The Last Unknown. We also have a lot of really incredible behind-the-scenes footage and reels and shows and photos and photo galleries in my other Discovery digital series, Nature in Focus, which people can see by visiting discovery.com/natureinfocus.
Oh, that's terrific. I will definitely head on over there. Well, Ian Shive, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice again about your work. You are an amazing wildlife photographer, really bringing the beauty of the natural world to our eyes, and most lately with The Last Unknown on Discovery Plus. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Ian Shive is an Ansel Adams Award-winning photographer, filmmaker, author, and environmentalist. You can find stills from The Last Unknown and more about the film at writersvoice.net. We have some time left in the show, so let's listen to a poem by Philip Schultz, who lives in East Hampton, New York, where I also live. His poem, Greed, contemplates the dignity and worth of the immigrants who live and work in our town. And that leads him to ponder what's really important.
Greed. My ocean town struggles to pick up leaves, offer summer school, and keep our library open. Every day now, more men stand at the railroad station, waiting to be chosen for work. Because it's thought the Hispanics will work for less, they get picked first, while the whites and blacks avoid each other's eyes. Our handyman, Santos, who expects only what his hands earn, is proud of his half acre in Guatemala, where he plans to retire. His desire to proceed with dignity is admirable, but he knows that now no one retires. Everyone works harder. My father imagined a life more satisfying than the one he managed to lead. He didn't see himself as uneducated, thwarted, or bitter, but soon to be rich. Being rich was his right, he believed. Happiness, I used to think, was a necessary illusion. Now I think it's just precious moments of relief, like dreams of Guatemala. Sometimes at night, in winter, surrounded by the significant silence of empty mansions, which once were cottages where people lived their lives, and are now owned by banks and the absent rich. I like to stand at my window looking for a TV's futile flickering, always surprised to see, instead, the quaint, porous face of my reflection, immersed in darkness, its one abundance.
That was Philip Schultz reading the poem Greed from his poetry volume Luxury. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the whole interview. And speaking of our show, here's a preview from next week's episode where we talk with two contributors to The Caring Manifesto. It came out of The Care Collective, a group of five women who started meeting in 2017 to talk about how to create a more caring society.
We were all thinking about notions of care from our different disciplines, from a range of perspectives. And when we started talking to one another, we were really trying to make sense of what we saw at the time as the multiple crises of care that were already engulfing the world. So rising inequality everywhere, endless war. And at the time, the refugee crisis was in the news all the time. And looming over everything, of course, imminent environmental catastrophe. And so this reading group continued meeting and reading and discussing and debating and for about 2 years. And it was then after these 2 years that we decided to write the manifesto, which became the Care Manifesto, the Politics of Interdependence. But actually, when we began writing, we could never have anticipated how grimly urgent COVID would make the manifesto. So so that's in short sort of the Care Collective, the five authors who wrote the Care Manifesto together.
That was Catherine Rothenberg, one of the authors of the Care Manifesto. We'll talk with her and her co-author Lynn Siegel next week. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.